From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for April the 15th, 2018. Thanks for joining us as we take our weekly look at the world of politics and policy. We'll take you from City Hall to Springfield and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So on this chilly morning, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot, hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, we got a tease of spring last week. Wednesday and Thursday kind of showed us that it's out there.
And it was laughing at us, too.
Yes. Yeah,
as you said, it was a tease. That's exactly right.
And it was a snarky laugh, too, you know?
Right.
I did have the chance to go see the Cubs on Wednesday night, thanks to my daughter taking me to the game. And it was nice to see a big victory there. And that Javi Baez is something else. I got to tell you, there's only one speed to his bat. And I mean, there was one swing he took Wednesday and he pulled a foul ball just, you know, down the third baseline, but fell over in the batter's box. And it's one of those where, man, don't hurt yourself, not getting out of the batter's box. But, you know, you got that game, then the bats went cold, and then you have a game for the ages yesterday.
Yeah, it was something else.
9 runs with 2 outs off of 3 hits.
3 hits, that was it.
After and coming back from 10-2 to win 14-10. That just, I mean, there's that old saw that you never leave early, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very true. But how many people were still in the ballpark for this? Let's be honest.
Yeah, not too many. I mean, it was ugly.
Well, yeah, and I think Joe Maddon alluded to it being perhaps the worst conditions for baseball that he's ever seen.
And, yeah.
Well, I ran into some people from Atlanta. There were a lot of folks in from Atlanta for this, and they told me that this was the only Braves series at Wrigley this year.
Yeah, that's true, because they're in the other division, so those teams only come in once, and the Cubs go there once. Same thing with the White Sox and teams that are not in their division. So that was kind of the reason why the game right. had to be played yesterday, because, you know, baseball is already inundated now. I mean, look what happened to the White Sox. They have 3 games called off this weekend against the Twins.
Basically a series.
Yeah, I mean, luckily enough, I mean, this is a division team, so the White Sox go back there in June. You can make those games up. Probably it'll be 3 doubleheaders.
Yeah, exactly.
If that's the way they decide to want to do it. But, you know, there's a lot of questions that were surrounding, you know, is this a team decision before the first pitch? Is this whose decision is this? And I think Major League Baseball, over the last couple of years, has gotten much more involved in the decision making before the umpires had the lineup cards,
right?
Especially with teams that are only coming in once.
No, that's as soon as they told that to me, and you know, these days it's hard to keep track about scheduling.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as they said that, I said, well, I guess that is the reason why they're playing. But let's be honest, that was not. I mean, it was the great thing that Coach Nagy was there to celebrate Bears weather at Wrigley Field.
Yes, sir.
Because that just was such a miserable, miserable day.
Yeah, it was miserable, and the conditions were unbaseball-like. I mean, you could kind of tell in that 8th inning. And again, each team had to play in it, so it wasn't sided to one team.
Right.
But, you know, you talk about, you know, 2-hit batters, 5 walks.
Oh, the pitchers had no control on the baseball.
Yeah, it was disgusting.
I mean, between the mist and the rain and the wind, they had no idea where they were throwing. And I mean, that the wild pitch that turned into a then throwing error
mm-hmm.
that just kind of sealed the game. I mean, yeah, it looks horrible, but it's understandable, I think.
Yeah, and there was no grip on the ball whatsoever. There have been people that have complained about the baseball they're going back to last year too, saying it's different. It's a little slicker. So you know, factor in the mist and the cold. It's even that much more hard to control just because you don't have a good grip on it all the time. So that was part of it. But you're tuning in, you're just like, wait a minute, is there fog on my television set? Did I have to wipe off the TV screen here?
And I'll admit, I did tune out of the game when it was 10-4.
It's okay.
Because I had to get on with the rest of the day and stop at the grocery store because it seems like even though it's spring, I have a fix for Cajun, so I made some red beans and rice.
Nice.
So that's been simmering all night. So
you didn't tell me about that.
I know.
Purposely, probably.
Well, you have other plans, Mr. Schwann. You're going to celebrate.
This afternoon? Yes.
You're going to celebrate your dad's birthday, yep. Which is a very happy birthday to
yep.
him.
Yep. 96 today.
How about that?
So we're looking forward to dinner inside.
Yes.
No grilling tonight.
And some friends coming by later on. No grilling tonight. No, well, unfortunately. And, you know, as we mentioned in the weather here, Rick and Andy, 20 degrees below normal for this date. And there's a winter weather advisory until this afternoon for Lake County, Illinois, Boone, McHenry, and then we have a flood warning until 10 o'clock this morning for the lakeshore.
It's good weather to watch the Stanley Cup. which I have to admit, I did stay up a little late to watch the Bruins and the Maple Leafs just because, old original six kind of game. David Pastrnak, 21 years old, gets a hat trick. Six total points, and that Boston first line, they had 14 points for the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, seven, I mean, you know.
They scored seven goals.
Yeah, but 7-3 victory. They had four goals, I think, in the first 5 minutes of the game.
Yeah, I think they scored on three consecutive shots.
Yeah.
At one point.
A tremendous, tremendous effort by Boston. I mean, that they look very tough. Although, I'm kind of my little side team here with the Blackhawks not in play. Mm-hmm. The Vegas Golden Knights.
Yeah.
2-0. With a double overtime win over Los Angeles on Friday night, which I think is that was also the a record for the longest game that the Kings had ever played, mm-hmm. as well, as it turned out. But, yeah, how about this team? I mean, just unbelievable. And meanwhile, my Aunt Jo's beloved Minnesota Wild.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, down two games.
That's my sleeper team is the Jets.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there was one point in the third period that the Wild did not have a shot on goal until about 3 minutes were left in the third period.
I believe
in
it.
In that period.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't. There's no way you can beat that kind of a defense at all. And I got to tell you, yeah, Winnipeg is the team to watch. I think.
Yeah, they're exciting. I mean, they kind of remind me of the Hawks of '09.
And it was funny because the game was at Winnipeg, and they're all dressed in white,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of the away color.
Yeah,
and I guess they call it a whiteout.
It's a white, something. Yeah. They call it for the fans all in white T-shirts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seemed kind of weird at first when I was looking at it, like who's rooting for who here, mm-hmm. kind of thing. But still. There's nothing like Stanley Cup playoff hockey.
I know, but I was just having a hard time yesterday watching it going,
yeah, why aren't we there?
I'm just not used to this.
I know. It is very frustrating, especially when you see this is always a problem I've found is these when they show commercials with athletes from great teams,
mm-hmm.
that are not in the tournament.
Yeah, the Patrick Kane and Duncan Keith commercial for that sports drink.
Yes. Yeah, that would be the one that kind of just, it's like, you really have to rub it in.
Yeah.
It doesn't do much for selling the product.
No, and I'm sure that was filmed or taped many, many months ago, and no one many, many months ago thought this would be the end-all the end result.
Yeah, obviously. No one thought that.
No.
That's for sure. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy's got the latest sports. Producer Casera's back to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And we're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Ben is in, and he's looking for his umbrella. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast on iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here inside the Allstate Showcase studio on a rainy North Michigan Avenue. And I guess it was appropriate for that White Sox promo that there were sleigh bells in the background. But no, there is no White Sox baseball today. Last three games all canceled because of heavy snow in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. In fact, Winnipeg was supposed to fly to Minneapolis and St. Paul for their game against the Wild, and they were turned back at Duluth and sent back to Winnipeg. So bad storm conditions there. So Sox are on their way to Oakland for their next series there. Well, it's been a busy week through national politics, as it always seems to be. Friday night, we get the news from President Trump that the U.S., the United Kingdom, and France led a joint airstrike in Syria in response to Bashar al-Assad's use of chemical weapons on his own people. Here's the president.
1 year ago, Assad launched a savage chemical weapons attack against his own innocent people. The United States responded with 58 missile strikes that destroyed 20% of the Syrian Air Force. Last Saturday, the Assad regime again deployed chemical weapons to slaughter innocent civilians, this time in the town of Douma, near the Syrian capital of Damascus. This massacre was a significant escalation in a pattern of chemical weapons use by that very terrible regime. The evil and the despicable attack left mothers and fathers, infants and children, thrashing in pain and gasping for air. These are not the actions of a man. They are crimes of a monster instead.
Now, the Russians had claimed that the news of a chemical attack was fake and a ruse, one faked by Britain. At the United Nations, the U.S. Ambassador, Nikki Haley, called out both Syria and the Russians.
See that a Russian disinformation campaign is in full force this morning. But Russia's desperate attempts at deflection cannot change the facts. A large body of information indicates that the Syrian regime used chemical weapons in Douma on April 7th. There is clear information demonstrating Assad's culpability. The pictures of dead children were not fake news. They were the result of the Syrian regime's barbaric inhumanity. And they were the result of the regime and Russia's failure to live up to their international commitments to remove all chemical weapons from Syria.
Now, all of this coming as former FBI Director James Comey, fired by Trump, is out with a new book. This morning, the president already tweeting, "Unbelievably, James Comey states that polls where crooked Hillary was leading were a factor in the handling, parentheses stupidly, of the Clinton email probe. In other words, he was making decisions based on the fact that he thought she was going to win and he wanted a job. Slimeball! Exclamation point, unquote. So just to get that right, so Comey releases information that's damaging to Hillary Clinton's election chances in hopes that he was going to get a job and she was going to win. That is what the president tweeted out this morning. Now, there's not some very flattering things in this book about the president, so that probably explains why White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders reacted the way she did.
The president came out swinging today, calling James Comey a liar, a leaker, a slimeball. Is he worried about what
he say?
Not at all. The American people see right through the blatant lies of a self-admitted leaker. This is nothing more than a poorly executed PR stunt by Comey to desperately rehabilitate his tattered reputation and enrich his own bank account by peddling a book that belongs in the bargain bin of the fixin' section instead of being remembered as a dedicated servant in the pursuit of justice. Like so many of his other colleagues at the FBI, Comey will be forever known as a disgraced partisan hack that broke his sacred trust with the President of the United States, the dedicated agents of the FBI, and the American people he vowed to faithfully serve. One of the President's greatest achievements will go down as firing Director James Comey.
Not exactly sure where the fixin' section is in the bookstore, if that's maybe the cookbook section, not quite too sure. But Comey's higher loyalty is out on Tuesday, but he sat down with George Stephanopoulos of ABC News for a special airing tonight. In one segment, Comey discusses that Steele dossier and having the conversation with Donald Trump about it. And he said that at one point, Trump thought about having the FBI investigate it to prove to his wife that it wasn't true.
Says he may want me to investigate it to prove that it didn't happen. And then he says something that distracted me, because he said, you know, if there's even a 1% chance my wife thinks that's true, that's terrible. And I remember thinking, how could your wife think there's a 1% chance you were with prostitutes peeing on each other in Moscow? I'm a flawed human being, but there's literally zero chance that my wife would think that was true. So what kind of marriage to what kind of man does your wife think there's only a 99% chance you didn't do that? And I said to him, sir, when he started talking about it, I may order you to investigate that. I said, sir, that's up to you, but you'd want to be careful about that because it might create a narrative that we're investigating you personally. And second, it's very difficult to prove something didn't happen.
Did you believe his denial?
Honestly, never thought these words would come out of my mouth, but I don't know whether the current president of the United States with prostitutes peeing on each other in Moscow in 2013, it's possible.
That's former FBI Director James Comey in an interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC News. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Oh. All right. Thought we were going to take a quick break there, but actually, up ahead on The Sunday Spin, after we catch up with the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak with my Tribune colleague, Hal Dardick. Hal and fellow reporter Ray Long authored a story about Cook County officials who oversee property tax appeals, taking contributions in excess of county ethics laws. We'll talk to him about that, the race for Cook County Democratic chairman, and the budding race for Chicago mayor.
Now, The Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to The Sunday Spin on this rainy, drizzly, and if you're in the counties along the border, perhaps icy Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, and this is your Sunday Spin. Last week, we had the sudden but not surprising announcement that House Speaker Paul Ryan of Janesville, Wisconsin, wouldn't seek re-election when his term expires. He now appears to be favoring Kevin McCarthy, his replacement. Ryan says his departure shouldn't affect Republican races needed to hold the GOP majority, but there are concerns. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan.
Worried about the impact of your announcement on the 2018 midterms and perhaps sending a signal that the House has lost for?
Yeah, I gave it some consideration, but I really do not believe whether I stay or go in 2019 is going to affect a person's individual race for Congress. I really don't think a person's race for Congress is going to hinge on whether Paul Ryan is Speaker or not. So I really don't think it affects it. Look, if we do our jobs, which we are, we're going to be fine as a majority. I'm grateful for the president to give us this chance to actually get this stuff done. I'm grateful that we have unified government, that the president, with his victory, gave us so we get all these big things done. We're going to have a great record to run on. We have a great economy, great accomplishments, more to do. And I really don't think that the American people are going to want to have the gridlock that the Democrats are promising. So I'm confident we can run to the tape and we can get this done.
That's House Speaker Paul Ryan. Joining me now on the phone is my Tribune colleague, Hal Dardick. Hal worked with another good friend of mine, Ray Long, to write a story about Cook County officials who oversee property tax appeals, taking contributions in excess of county ethics laws. Hal, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's my pleasure as always, Rick, although it's a dreary morning.
I bet you had a hard time waking up this morning.
It was a little
Well, as always, thank you for joining me. Maybe you could kind of walk us through what exactly is going on involving these issues involving county ethics laws, campaign contributions, the property tax appeals process, because this isn't the first time this kind of subject has been broached.
No, as you noted, it was highlighted earlier this year, late last year, as Cook County Assessor Joe Barrios ran for re-election. And the issue is that the property tax appeals attorneys, the folks who largely represent wealthy commercial property owners, sometimes homeowners, who go before the assessor's office and go to what's known as the Board of Review, perhaps the least known county agency of all, to get their assessments lowered so their property tax bills are reduced, are the folks who contribute far and away the most in campaign money to Joe Barrios and the three elected members of the Board of Review. Now, back in October of 2016, the county board, because they were concerned about the idea that, if not the reality, that these attorneys are contributing money so that they can get more favorable treatment, you know, the quid pro quo, pay-to-play type of politics that Cook County, at least in the bad old days, was known for, limited those contributions to $750 per year or $1,500 in an election year. But basically, all of these four officials, Joe Barrios, the three commissioners on the Board of Review, there's one Republican, two Democrats who sit on that board, ignored those contribution limits and continued to take money in excess of that. Joe Barrios was cited for that. And so were the commissioners last summer. All the commissioners gave the contributions that were in excess as defined by the Board of Ethics under the ordinance back to the contributors. Assessor Barrios said, no, I'm not giving it back. I don't think that that law is constitutional. And he continued to fight that through his failed, now as we know, failed re-election effort. But because he was in court, the court placed a stay on that. He continued to accept hundreds and thousands of dollars from these folks, using that money to wage his campaign, which Fritz Kagi ended up winning. The commissioners continued to accept the money, too, even though they'd given it back before, and which is what Ray and I just discovered. Ray did a Freedom of Information Act. He got this information from the Board of Ethics that they had accepted, continued to accept tens of thousands of dollars each in excess contributions from these folks, even after they'd been placed on notice last summer. And now they have until Monday to, between Assessor Barrios and then give back like $440,000 to these contributors. It's just an interesting issue in that I think that the assessor, everyone was well aware, but nobody knows about the Board of Review. And if they can't, these property tax appeals attorneys can't get satisfaction or a favorable ruling at the assessor's office, they have the right to go to the Board of Review and get those commissioners to consider their case. So even if you've the new assessor who will the likely new assessor, Fritz Kagi, when he gets installed, he's promised not to take this money. You still got these three commissioners who might take the money, although they might be severely limited in that, but you still got this concern out there of pay-to-play politics.
Well, and certainly we saw how the issue of property taxes were highlighted in part by the Tax Divide series in the Tribune, and the question about the fairness of the assessment method and concerns that commercial development paid less of the burden of property taxes, and that shifted the burden onto homeowners, generally homeowners in areas that where their property was not assessed correctly.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and the line from especially Assessor Barris and from the three commissioners is always that, well, if it is, we didn't get it right in the first place, you can come and appeal it. But what that Tax Divide series showed was that the appeals actually made the system what they call more regressive, meaning more of the property tax burden as a result of those appeals was shifted from the wealthy to the less affluent, making the system even less fair.
Because it was dependent on the property owner, a residential property owner, to try to navigate their way or pay for one of these property tax appeals attorneys. And the property tax appeals attorneys get typically, if they win that appeal, they get a percentage of the cut of the savings.
That's right, a significant cut. It can be a very lucrative business. And there's, you know, the ancillary issue, too, of some of the folks that are in that business, whether it be House Speaker Michael Madigan or powerful Chicago Alderman Ed Burke.
So, this was something that Joe Berrios had challenged in court. Where do we stand in the legal process on this?
Yeah, the court in the weeks leading up to the election ruled against Assessor Barris, which lifted the stay on enforcement by the Board of Ethics of this ordinance, which is why these notices went out in late March. They were free to again start citing people who had violated the ordinance. Barrios has appealed that case. He's looking, this hasn't been heard by the appellate court, to get another stay at the time. Interestingly, the one commissioner, when we tried, you know, to let them have their say when we did this story, the one who returned our call, Dan Patlack, Republican member of the board, said he continued to accept the contributions because he thought Barrios' case had merit, and he wanted to wait for the outcome of that case. We don't know if that's true for the other two commissioners, but perhaps that was what they were thinking. But now it goes to the appellate court, and I wouldn't be surprised if this went all the way to the Supreme Court when we get a final determination as to whether these limits are constitutional or not.
Yeah, because we're kind of in this gray area of what we've seen with the U.S. Supreme Court rule on campaign contributions and money is speech kind of thing and Citizens United, but also at the same time, there was the right to restrict contributions when it was due to appearances of conflict of interest.
Right. There are some federal limits, despite you know what is Supreme Court that has decided that you know, corporations are people, and they've got the right to free speech, and lifted certain other limits. But when there's a conflict of interest, there is a right to limit that. Whether that, you know, applies to this particular circumstance, we'll have to see.
We're speaking by Tribune colleague Hal Dardick. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined on the phone by my Tribune colleague Hal Dardick. Al and fellow reporter Ray Long wrote a piece about the Cook County officials who oversee property tax appeals taking contributions in excess of county ethics laws. And Al, one more thing on this topic I wanted to ask you is, what are the law firms that gave the money? What do they say for their reasons for giving?
That would be a good question. We contacted.
Well, you asked. I know you asked the question.
yes, we did. There were more than 45 of these firms that we didn't call them all. What we did was we took the six that we discovered had given to not only the six of them gave to all four officials, to Assessor Barrios and all three commissioners on the Board of Review. We contacted the top attorneys at each of those six firms. None of them would go on the record to speak about this, so we can't know specifically what they're thinking. They, for whatever reason, didn't want to talk to the Tribune about the excess contributions. The questions we had is, do you hope to get something from these contributions? Do you hope, why did you, were you aware of these limits, so that we couldn't get any answers on it. Interestingly, of those six, there were four of them that gave to not only the three or the four officials, but they gave basically twice to Joe Barrios, and once to his reelection committee, and another time to the 31st Ward Democratic organization that he also controls.
Spreading the money around the infield, as it were.
Yes.
Let's shift gears here a little bit. Speaking of Joe Barrios, he is no longer going to be the Cook County Democratic chairman, and a number of people have expressed interest in the job. I would say most notably is Cook County Board Chairman Tony Preckwinkle.
Right, yeah, they're going to have their internal Cook County Democratic Party elections on Thursday. So it was interesting that Joe Barrios, of course, suffered a defeat, decided he's not going to run again for chairman of the party. Meanwhile, Preckwinkle, despite the controversial and now a repealed pop tax last year, did well in her election, and the candidates she backed did very well, with the exception of Joe Barrios. And so she's going to run. I don't think it's a big secret at this point that by all accounts folks expect her to become the new chairman. The big question that comes up at this meeting is what will she do in an era where patronage politics is even further weakened than ever and can't necessarily deliver the votes. Joe Barrios is the prime example. When election time comes in, what will she do or propose to do to retool the party, and who will she pick to serve, or who will the party pick, the 80 committeemen, to serve on that executive committee with President Preckwinkle? And what will they do to change a party that's less effective come election time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that seems to be, with a new chairman, that points to time of change, but at the same time, the change on the outside has been happening very rapidly. And what is the future of the Cook County Democratic organization? Now, obviously, machine politics aren't anywhere near what they were decades ago. But when you have kind of a Democratic Party that's also struggling to find its way, like the Republican Party is, but a Democratic Party where it has kind of counted on organizational strength before, but finds itself facing kind of the, I guess, more of an insurgent, progressive, left-leaning side to the party, and perhaps even a younger side of the party, where does she take the party forward?
Exactly. I couldn't put that any better. You had the, of course, Chuy Garcia isn't one of these young guns, but he's always represented progressive ideals, and the young folks that he supported in the last election did very well against the people that were backed by what's left of the machine. And you've got to somehow harness, I think, what they're bringing to the party, which is a different style of politics. It doesn't depend on patronage, but engaging people through issues and find a way, I would suppose, for more traditional, perhaps more conservative Democrats and the progressives to work together, find common ground. Is as we all know, you know, that's been tough in the Republican Party with the Tea Party influence, and I think some people might characterize the progressives as sort of the Tea Party of the left, although I don't know that description is apt, but I think I've heard that thrown around.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see exactly how, and there's also, obviously, and you mentioned Chuy Garcia, there's the diversity angle as well, and the growing role of Hispanics in Democratic Party politics. Hal Dardick, political and investigative reporter, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure as always, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I was just out on the Storm Center patio, and I'm not sure that we're going to hit that 40 degrees, Mr. Schwann.
Well, don't kill the messenger.
I'm not.
We're all annoyed enough with the weather as it is. So.
Yeah, it is really gloomy out there and cold. It's definitely not grilling season.
Well, then you don't want to hear about the winter weather advisory until 1 o'clock this afternoon. Boone, Lake McHenry, and Winnebago counties. So winter weather advisory on April 15th.
Yeah. And, of course, we all think of April 15th in a bad enough light over taxes, even though it's the 17th.
The 17th this year, yes.
But still, yeah, just something that puts you in the right spirit of mind, right?
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday to you.
Thank you.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg went to Congress last week amid concerns about privacy sparked by Cambridge Analytics' use of Facebook data and its association with the Donald Trump presidential campaign. An awkward moment came when Senior Democratic Senator Dick Durbin had some questions of Mr. Zuckerberg.
Would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
If you messaged anybody this week, would you share with us the names of the people you've messaged?
Senator, no, I would probably not choose to do that publicly here.
I think that may be what this is all about. Your right to privacy, the limits of your right to privacy, and how much you give away in modern America in the name of, quote, connecting people around the world. The question, basically, of what information Facebook's collecting, who they're sending it to, and whether they ever asked me in advance my permission to do that. Is that a fair thing for a user of Facebook to expect?
Yes, Senator. I think everyone should have control over how their information is used. And as we've talked about in some of the other questions, I think that is laid out in some of the documents, but more importantly, you want to give people control in the product itself. So the most important way that this happens across our services is that every day people come to our services to choose to share photos or send messages, and every single time they choose to share something, they have a control right there about who they want to share it with. But that level of control is extremely important.
That's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Joining me now here in the studio to talk about that testimony and other things is Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern University Law School. Jason, thank you so much.
Rick, great to be here. Good to see you.
Good to see you as always on this lovely day, this lovely Sunday.
It's fabulous. Isn't outside.
It? Yes, it is. One thing I was struck by the testimony, and also with issues involving Facebook dating back for 15 years now, is the constant, I apologize, we'll try to do better. And with the digital era and people getting used to the concepts of social media and you know, early on, I can understand that. But when you get to be a company as large as Facebook, and it's still like, well, we're still learning, and dealing with how they make money, are you allowed a learning curve? Or is this just me being the crotchety old man?
Can it be both?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think your reservation was echoed in a lot of the questioning across the 2 days, both in the House hearings and in the Senate hearings on day one, particularly Jan Schakowsky and Martha Blackburn on the House side.
10 hours of hearings.
Yes, 10 hours of hearings. And they expressed that feeling, like you've apologized many, many times. There was even an exhibit that was put up on the first day during the Senate hearings that had all of his apologies throughout the years, not all before Congress, but
right.
But publicly. Despite that reservation, I think for the people on the Hill and also for people who use Facebook, I think there is a sense that a learning curve makes sense. For the people on the Hill, if you listen to that questioning, Rick, they just weren't that aggressive with him.
Well, and I think particularly perhaps on the Senate side, a lot of them didn't really have a concept of what social media is.
Well, that's some of it. I think the lack of preparation, which goes back to a lack of knowledge about the technology.
I mean, Orrin Hatch asked, how do you make money at this?
Well, he read for pages and pages of a prepared text as though he were reading it, as though he were just thinking of these things off the top of his right. head that explained that whole business model.
Right.
And then asked a question that I think was written for him as a friendly question to Facebook. Like, if people want this service for free, then an ad model is the model that we're going to have to accept. And with that comes some costs. But he asked it in a way that made it sound like an accusatory question. So it made no sense.
Right.
And that's why Zuckerberg said, well, it's basically what you just said. We sell ads. But the questions were, they were moderated to some extent. And I take it that there were two things that were going on. One, that the members of Congress were not that well educated about what they were asking. And two, they were just generally deferential for a couple of reasons. One is that their constituents like Facebook. 70% of the country uses Facebook. 2 billion people around the planet use Facebook. And unlike a credit agency or the head of a credit agency who would come in there like Rick Smith did for Equifax in the fall and get battered because those members of Congress are expressing public outrage, with Facebook there is a modicum of outrage, but also that whole movement about hashtag delete Facebook, not a lot of people are deleting Facebook. And that's a piece of it. The other piece of it is Facebook has been very savvy over the years with its outreach. I mean, if you were to watch those hearings, the number of representatives and senators who thanked Mark Zuckerberg for being there voluntarily and also for helping out with our small business event, or Elliot Engel, who's a representative from Westchester County in New York, said, I know you graduated from a high school here. We'd love for you to come back and do an event. So Facebook has been out there for years and years, and they've curried a lot of favor, and the public tends to use the service. It's become, in a way, integral to the way people connect. I don't use it, but you do for the show, right? And many other people use it.
And people in media, quite frankly, that is a way to
help. Sort of required to use it. And the idea of quitting Facebook is very difficult to do, both in terms of staying connected to other people, but also for people's livelihood. Facebook is now hardwired into that part of people's lives as well. So for all of those reasons, I think there was a lot of deference to the so-called apology tour. And also, Zuckerberg was well prepared And at least on day one before the Senate, he seemed contrite. I mean, you can say the words and not look like you mean it, but he did seem like he meant it. On day two, the House hearing, he was a little testier. He looked more tired, honestly, and he didn't do as well.
Right. Now, and we're going to talk more about this. We're going to take a quick break. I'm with Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer of Northwestern University Law School. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate UK studio and historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. And joining me in studio is my good friend Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern University Law School. We've been talking about Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg's testimony before Congress, 10 hours of testimony. And I was very curious when Zuckerberg said that he would be open to regulation. Federal regulation in regards to assuming in regards to privacy, not exactly the answer that I had thought was going to come from a social media exec,
but consistent with the larger strategy that I take it that he had, particularly with Congress. So that's one of the main audiences he had. He's sitting right in front of them. Some other audiences include investors, include the users of Facebook, include the press, include even Facebook employees. And I think for the audience of the Congress, the main message was, we do good. We've made some mistakes. I take responsibility. We're going to further investigate everything. And then we're willing to work with you to see what the best route is. And that is a very prudent sounding, contrite, responsible sounding message.
Because we're not talking specifics.
Right. And in fact, what he said, Rick, was he was open to the right kind of regulation. And that's an important qualifier. In the European regime, in the EU, there's much more rigorous regulation of data privacy. And so he was asked several times whether he would adopt something similar to what they'd done in the European Union. And his response was something to the effect of, they do some things well. And I take it that is, he does not want as robust of a protection as they had in Europe. And so his pivot constantly was, we don't want to just do what's legally responsible. We want to do what is morally right. And that is a way to both take the heat off the idea of actually committing to regulation and also boosting his credibility before the committee and the public as a whole. They also rolled out some initiatives and have signaled that they would support the requirement of ads, political ads, being labeled on Facebook. And so that...
Well, and they even kind of advanced that before it got into kind of legislative form.
Yes, and they rolled out a bunch of things in the days before the hearing, which is a classic tactic to really kind of lay the groundwork for the performance that you're going to give at the hearing and take some of the sting out of it and mollify. And I think in the short term, he did. Number one being, when you get down to it, I think the question that was being presented there and which was effectively framed was, do you trust the people who are asking these questions to write the regulations? And based on the performance of the members of Congress, I think you had to be a little skeptical of them being up to the task as well. So in that sense, as well as with all the audiences, I think there was a modicum of short-term success for Zuckerberg. I think the stock price stabilized. He made a bunch of money those couple of days. And the public at large, it took some of the wind out of the sails of Delete Facebook. And there was even some reports that as for Facebook employees, as for that audience, they were very heartened by what he did. But all that is short and intermediate term. There still are plenty of questions about whether they actually violated a Federal Trade Commission consent decree from 2011 in the process of relinquishing a lot of data to Cambridge Analytica. They've got a bunch of internal audits that are still going on. They kept saying they're going to answer a bunch of questions that they couldn't get to in the format. And there were some questions that he answered in a way that I think were a little surprising about how much he knew about the kinds of profiles that Facebook gathers on people who aren't even using Facebook. And he pled a level of ignorance about that that I think surprised a lot of people. So whether it comes out that he was playing a little fast and loose with that, that's another measure of his long-term success here.
Well, I mean, and you hear, well, when we told Cambridge Analytica to stop using the data and destroy it, we thought they did.
Right.
Well, what does that mean?
And that goes to their responsibilities under the consent decree and also the kinds of things that their own audit are going to potentially discover when they go through it. So they, he also said they were considering weighing some legal action against Cambridge Analytica. He didn't commit to anything. So it was kind of this consistency of, we're going to keep looking into it. And that's what we normally would counsel somebody if we're coaching them to be at a hearing, is you've got to be cooperative. Not only look cooperative, but you actually have to take the actions that are cooperative to make it ring true. And he followed that playbook. And I think that worked, but that is, like they used to say with the NCAA tournament, survive in advance, right? He survived in advance, but there's a lot that's still to be determined.
And, you know, as we talk about regulation and issues about regulation of social media, issues of regulation of the internet, we have this whole debate about net neutrality that continues, and states looking to see whether they can enact their own net neutrality laws, usurping federal rights, which that's a whole other legal argument. But I know that that's a subject that you're going to be helping feature at Northwestern.
We are, Rick. Thanks for mentioning it. So this Tuesday night, we have a debate at Northwestern Law School on the proposition preserve net neutrality. And this is the second of our partnership debates between the Minow debates from our great Newt Minow, graduated from Northwestern Law School, still very active in our community, and the father of presidential debates, former FCC chair. And we're in partnership with IQ Squared, Intelligence Squared US, which is a incredible organization out of New York that has sponsored and put on about 100 Oxford debates over the last 10 years or so on a whole range of topics. So we worked with them in the fall of 2005 in our inaugural debate, which was on prosecutor power, which was a big success, and I think people learned a lot there. And this is the second in the series, so this one is on net neutrality. And this is an issue that I think is often, if not misunderstood, simply not understood. And it's really pretty basic. Everything we're talking about with Facebook or with Amazon or with Google, those are questions primarily about what those internet giants do with information that we provide. Net neutrality is about Comcast and Verizon, other types of tech giants, controlling the information we receive.
The pipeline.
And what it really comes down to are the same issues of corporate power, but the question in this case is, that wire that runs into your home or the wireless that you have in your hand, we have come to be used to getting it, turning it on and getting it, but it's being delivered. And the question is, can the deliverers of that information slow down websites, speed up other websites that they like or that people are willing to pay more for, or can they block websites completely? And net neutrality is just a term that means the internet will be open and free, and that those providers, those Comcast and Verizon, will not have that power. Under the Obama FCC, they instituted net neutrality. That was in 2015. The Trump FCC in the fall of 2017 took it away. The rules actually become official next week. And because those rules are about to become official, 23 states have filed suit against the FCC. 26 states have legislation pending, including Illinois, regarding net neutrality. And there are also 5 executive orders in states, as well as a whole bunch of federal litigation. The United States Congress is considering overriding what the FCC did. And the implications of this whole thing are political. In other words, how much social organizing can there actually be? We talk about hashtag MeToo. We talk about Black Lives Matter. Would those social movements have moved as quickly as they can and do if the internet can be controlled by the gatekeepers? Similarly, consumer choice. Everybody likes Netflix. When this order becomes official, are the Comcast and Verizons of the world going to turn around to Netflix and say, you take up a lot of bandwidth, we're going to charge you more, at which point Netflix will turn around to me and you and say, I'm going to charge you more, or Twitter's going to charge you per tweet, or Facebook is going to charge you per post. Those are the kinds of questions that are at play. And the people on the other side of the issue say the internet has been fine for years without net neutrality. All the development you've seen has been about competition, and that's simply going to continue. So Tuesday night, we're going to debate that issue. We've got 4 sensational debaters. Tom Wheeler, who's the FCC chair who instituted net neutrality, is going to be one of the debaters on the 4 side. His partner is going to be Mitchell Baker, who is a pioneer, the executive chairwoman of Mozilla, the fine people who brought you Firefox. And on the anti-side will be a former FCC chief economist, Michael Katz, who's from Berkeley. And he'll be joined by the always provocative Nick Gillespie, one of the great libertarian thinkers in our country, and some would say a gadfly, but one of the great debaters, and somebody who appears on Real Time with Bill Maher, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, all the time. So 6:15 on Tuesday night. And for our lawyer friends in the audience tonight, Rick, two continuing legal education credits.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, so it'll be great. And Newt Minow will be there. And the way that Newt sees it is, when he was the FCC chair, he made the vast wasteland speech to get broadcasters to serve the public interest. Internet is today's television. The question is, will it serve the public interest? Tuesday night, 6:15, Northwestern Law School.
Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern University Law School. Thank you, as always, for joining me
this
morning.
Thank you, Rick.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. You know, it's no secret that the president isn't happy with special counsel Robert Mueller or his boss, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Issues involving raiding Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen. Cohen due in court on Monday. Rosenstein has told Confidence that he expects to be fired. In Congress, their efforts to provide legal protections to Mueller, House Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, led by New York's Jerry Nadler, questioned whether Republicans would stand up for justice.
This important legislation builds in protections for the special counsel investigation and allows for judicial review to separate political interference from the carrying out of justice. Unfortunately, it seems Republican leadership in the House lacks the spine to take a stand against President Trump's abuse of power or to defend our country from the constitutional crisis we would face if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation were terminated or interfered with in any way.
That's Jerry Nadler, Democratic congressman from New York, speaking for House Democrats on the Judiciary Committee. Joining me now on the phone is Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy from Schaumburg, from the 8th Congressional District. He's a member of the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. Congressman, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick.
You know, it seems like these days there's never a shortage of things to talk about going on in Washington. We've got the issue of the special counsel and what's going on at the Department of Justice. But before that we begin, I wanted to ask you about the decision Friday for the joint allied airstrikes on Syria. And everybody understands the great trauma and terror caused by the Assad regime using chemical weapons on his own people. Still the issue of congressional oversight for military action.
Yes, thank you for having me on. Look, Bashar al-Assad is an authoritarian dictator who needs to go. And he has used chemical weapons routinely on his own people. And I support the president working with our allies, such as France and Great Britain, to come up with a multilateral, set of actions with regard to Assad. But the problem is that, I think the president said that mission accomplished, but we don't know what the mission is. Is it to overthrow Assad? Is it to bring about peace and stability with Assad continuing as the leader of Syria? Is it to end the use of chemical weapons? Just a year ago, he launched similar strikes, and Assad continues to use chemical weapons. So what is the end strategy here? And then finally, Congress must have a say in the use of force. I think that he should come to Congress to ask for the authority for any further action, because at the end of the day, our men and women in uniform are doing the best possible job they could ever do in this very challenging situation, but they do put themselves at risk, and the commander-in-chief puts themselves at risk. And so we have to have a say.
Well, and this coming off the fact that it was only days ago that he was talking about wanting to have U.S. military forces out of Syria in a matter of days.
Right. He said he wanted out of Syria, and apparently he told some aides he wanted to get out in 48 hours. And then just a day later or so, We are launching airstrikes in Syria, further, kind of deepening our involvement there. So I think we're kind of lurching right now, Rick, and I think that's really bad, not only for Syria, but also for our men and women in uniform, and therefore Congress, you know, must have a say in this process.
I know you've been seeing some of the reports about former FBI Director James Comey's book and some of the things that have come out in that. I can't say that I necessarily find great new revelations in the material, but it seems to me more of a question, and in fact we had a question from a texter earlier today about would Comey have been better served after Trump had left office to write a book about this kind of thing, and about Comey's credibility in some of the conversations and discussions that he's had.
Right. You know, clearly, Donald Trump has been paying attention to this book. I think he's tweeted four times in the last hour and a half about Jim Comey. This is what I think. I think that I'm a little concerned about some of the some of the places and subject matter that Jim Comey decided to comment on, because I do think that it undermines his ability to be a witness or testify later in the Mueller probe. I think that right now the Mueller investigation has to be protected, and anything that can be fodder for undermining it would be, it'd be better for that not to happen.
Well, I know that I remember reading this just over the last couple of days about, and I believe it was more involving the Senate Democrats, kind of a directive that if Rosenstein's fired and Mueller is fired, that Democrats hold their powder for a few days to see how things shake out before immediately trying to use the I word.
Well, I think that certainly if Mueller were fired, I think that all heck would break loose. And I'm heartened that a lot of Republicans have made that clear. And I think they've said the same thing about Rosenstein as well, because I think that would amount to some charge of obstruction of justice. I think that overall, right now, I'd like to see some of that legislation go forward with regard to protecting Bob Mueller and bringing some judicial review to the process. Chuck Grassley in the Senate has talked about adding that provision to legislation, must-pass legislation, that is going through the Senate right now. I think if we can act in a bipartisan way with regard to at least protecting Bob Mueller and bringing a little more process, due process to his situation, I think that would be a positive step right now. President some pause.
That sounds like it's more of a bipartisan effort in the Senate than it does in the House, though.
So I think that if something came out of the Senate on what they call must-pass legislation, so as you know, there's a lot of gridlock in Washington, D.C., but there's legislation that both parties feel needs to go forward regardless of the politics. So just as an example, there's something called the NDAA, which is the National Defense Authorization Act, which basically, allows for our armed forces to get money to do what they have to do. And if someone like Chuck Grassley were to get such a provision attached to that type of must-pass legislation, then it would really force House Republicans to, potentially vote for it.
We're speaking with Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy from Schaumburg. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me on the phone is Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. Congressman, I know you've got a legislation that you're working on called the Conflict Act, which would require White House officials to disclose their reasons for recusing themselves from meetings or decisions. Could you just give us a little background on that, please?
Yeah, so on the Oversight Committee, I've been helping with leading an investigation into different people who've had conflicts of interest in the White House, one of them being Jared Kushner. I believe that Mr. Kushner probably has among the greatest conflicts of interest of anybody in the executive branch. He has various financial difficulties, and he has been basically meeting with different people in the White House, ostensibly to talk about official business, but then all of a sudden these same individuals or their companies end up helping his family's business concerns in a significant way. Just as an example, he met with people from Citigroup and also Apollo, the Apollo Financial Group, and together they provided hundreds of millions of dollars in loans to his family's business concerns. So what we are trying to do is, apparently in the White House, from time to time, they do require people to recuse themselves from certain meetings and discussions involving topics that might pertain to their personal business concerns. And what we're saying is, we want to know when that happens, and B, we want to know why. What is the nature of the conflict of interest that would lead to these recusals? We just need more transparency with regard to this process so we can hold them accountable.
How likely are we likely to see that legislation advance?
Maybe not in this Congress, Rick. Unfortunately, we have been asking Trey Gowdy and others to pursue some of these investigations with a little more vigor, and we haven't yet seen the desired outcome. Although I did call on Trey Gowdy to help us with Scott Pruitt of the EPA, who has conflicts of interest left and right, including a chief of staff who apparently has a consulting business on the side for the oil and gas industry, the very people that they are regulating. And he has, pursued this particular issue with Pruitt with a little more energy. But, with regard to the first issue, the Conflict Act, which we've introduced, I'm hoping that we can gather a little bit of momentum and maybe in the next Congress it passes.
Is it easier for somebody like Troy Gowdy to kind of take a look at Scott Pruitt just because of the myriad of stories and controversies surrounding him?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's been a lot of attention paid to Pruitt. I don't need to go through all the different things that...
I don't think we have time for that.
Right. Yeah, I don't think we have time. But on the other hand, Kushner deserves a lot of attention as well, and I hope that Mr. Gowdy, Chairman Gowdy, changes his approach there.
I also want to talk to you about the American Workers Act. If you could explain that. I know it's a kind of a tax credit system here.
Yeah, so my passion or focus in this Congress legislatively has been workforce development, workforce training, and career technical education. How do we make sure that, our workers, especially those who don't decide to get a four-year degree, a college degree, get the skills and tools and certifications and credentials to get access to a job? And how do we upgrade the skills of those who already have a job? So I introduced this bill with Senator Warner from Virginia, as well as Joe Crowley from New York, and Congresswoman Sanchez from California, to basically reward medium and small businesses who decide to spend extra going forward on workforce training, basically a 20% tax credit on the additional spend that they decide to make to, basically upgrade their workforce. And that's something we desperately need, because over the past two decades, there's actually been a drop off in the amount of money spent by businesses on the job training. So this is vitally needed for us to, propel forward economically.
Well, and it seems like when it comes to vocational training and, the larger conversation about the community college role in vocational training, that it's normally associated with a large institution.
That's right. And I think that we need to make sure that businesses also have an incentive to do more on the job. I really, without going into too much detail, I'm really hopeful about the efforts in the private sector to engage in what are called learn and earn opportunities. That is, you know, people who are working and at the same time getting additional tools, whether it's their whether it's at their local community college or otherwise, to basically upgrade their skills and, you know, help businesses at the same time. There are a lot of similar initiatives, but we need to provide additional incentives for especially small and medium-sized businesses to continue with this trend.
Well, we always kind of think of, in fact, we talked about in the last half hour about continuing education for,
yes,
you know, the professions, you know, like law and those kinds of,
yeah,
things. But there's value in that continuing education in all kinds of jobs.
That's right. That's right. I think that, you know, as we go forward, especially in this technology revolution that we're in, and we all know about the changes coming forward with regard to automation and the like, we have to make sure that our workers are equipped with the tools to take advantage of those particular trends and that they're not caught flat-footed. And I think that businesses are doing this, but we're not doing enough of it across the board. And in other places like Germany and other countries, this has become routine for them to invest in their workers in this vein. And I'd like to see that happen here.
Congressman, you know, given the departure of Paul Ryan, I know that Republicans, there's a lot of concern privately among Republicans about going into the midterm election. But I have to wonder, you know, on a larger scale, if this isn't kind of reflective of just the, some of the turmoil in Washington.
I think so. You know, look, Speaker Ryan said the other day that he was retiring to spend more time with his family. And actually, in this particular case, I think there's some truth to it. I think there's, I think he's sincere about that, especially given his personal story with his father having died when he was a teenager. That being said, I think that the other dimension of this is what you touched upon, which is, I think that he probably sees the likelihood of him serving as the next speaker, you know, going down with each passing day. I think that Democrats are increasingly hopeful about taking the majority back. I think the chances are looking better every day. And then secondly, dealing with President Trump is no walk in the park. I think that it's no, I don't think it's any secret that he and the president don't necessarily see eye to eye on a variety of issues. That being said, I was a little disappointed that he hasn't been more forceful in pushing back on the president with regard to a variety of issues. And he has kind of let the he's kind of ceded some of our legislative prerogative in Congress to the president. And so I'm hoping that maybe now that he's somewhat liberated, he'll do that in the remaining months. But let's see.
Well, I mean, I seem to remember, and this was before he was speaker, when he was here at the City Club in Chicago with Congressman Luis Gutierrez talking about the importance of immigration reform.
Right, right. That's just that's a perfect example, Rick. You know, Paul Ryan should bring a vote on the floor with regard to not only comprehensive immigration reform proposals that have passed the Senate in the in past Congresses, but also with regard to Dreamers. I mean, there's a clear majority in the House for finding a path for our Dreamers and DACA recipients who are right now in limbo, but he won't bring it to the floor unless the president endorses it. And we all know that the president has been going back and forth and, you know, in his support of any given proposal, whether it's bipartisan or not. And so I think the speaker hopefully will reconsider on some of these issues because it's the right thing to do and it also helps our economy.
Now you say you hope it's a liberating force. Do you actually believe it will be?
I don't know because, I, you know, look, I don't know the internal politics in the House Republican Conference. On the one hand, I guess it's a liberating force for him to announce his retirement and then perhaps go and quote-unquote do the right thing. But on the other hand, he has a lot of members who are putting pressure on him not to do these things because they fear backlash from their base. And so I, like I said, I'm hopeful that there would be a change of heart on some of these issues, but I'm not sure what's going to happen.
I guess we'll all stay tuned. Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Schaumburg, the 8th Congressional District, as always, thank you for joining me.
Hey, thank you, Rick.